the Stranger Still podcast. I'm Miles.
And I'm Kathleen.
Rewatching every episode of Stranger Things ahead of the May and July two-part release of season four.
All right, guys. It has been 3 years. Okay. Let's catch up together. Follow us at StrangerStill22 on Twitter.
Subscribe and review on Spotify, Anchor, Apple, wherever you watch your podcasts.
Like Shirley Temple's hick sister from Indiana, let's tuck this episode in real tight. The polarizing, but I am looking forward to discussing this episode, season two, chapter seven, The Lost Sister.
Quite different than the typical episode here. Start us off, babe.
Different vibe. We start, well, where we left off 11 in chapter five. We went a whole chapter without 11.
Yeah.
I missed her.
Yeah, we didn't see her at all last episode, did we?
We didn't. So we come back to 11. Millie Bobby Brown is back, baby. And she has just experienced her mom's visions. Breathe, sunflower, rainbow, 450. And 11 believes that Mama wants her to go looking for her rainbow sister, Callie.
So, yeah. So she tells Terry's sister, what's Terry's sister?
Aunt Becky.
So she tells Aunt Becky everything that she saw. Basically, Terry was not crazy. She about the other girl, and you know, she asks Becky about, you know, if she knows anything about any other kids, and Becky says, well, she did keep all of these missing child files. So she looks through and she finds an article about the girl she saw in the vision that Terry showed her, mama showed her.
Thankfully with a picture, and that's, we know 11's going to be able to find someone with a picture, but she doesn't. She doesn't right away.
No,
she like goes
yeah.
to the TV and she doesn't, which I found interesting.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
I don't know. Because then she finds her in her dreams, mm-hmm. which as far as I know, 11, without the blindfold, hasn't done this before in her dreams before. So we're seeing her powers change. I guess I don't really...
Change, grow.
Yeah. But she finds it in a dream. She comes down to tell Aunt Becky, yay, I found her. And Aunt Becky is a rat. She's rat. Well, I don't know. She's calling Hopper, right?
Yeah. No, she's not calling Hopper. She is calling the number that she never says Dr. Brenner, but you kind of surmise that by what she says in the conversation. You know, he gave me this number. I find any information. No, because she mentions Hopper. You know, a police officer named Hopper came by the house. And she even says a name who she's talking to, which I didn't notate that down here, but I surmise that it is a number that Dr. Brenner gave her out of faux concern at the time in case anything comes up.
Okay. Well, we'll have to go back. I surmise something different. I surmise that she's calling Hopper and Joyce, who had recently told her all this was true in season one, and she's calling them. That's what I thought. I will have to look back on it because she says Hopper, this policeman, came looking for her.
You know. The wife is always right.
The wife is always right. That's Lucas's dad's advice. She's never wrong.
That's right. Stranger Things even said it.
So 11, she sees that this is no longer a place she can stay, and she's off.
Yep. She leaves in pursuit of her sister.
Yeah.
In quotations here.
She arrives in Chicago to the tune of She's a Little Runaway.
Oh, perfectly chosen song. They
little on the nose.
They just do an excellent job of
Bon Jovi
music here.
Yeah.
I
thought this song was a little too on the nose. Yeah.
Oh, I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked it.
And so she's looking for it. She's like a little girl walking through the, you know, the empty alleyways of Chicago. And I'm like fearing for her. I'm like, wait, why am I fearing for 11?
She could just,
the guy who's like, they're all dead. They're all dead. I was like, what? He poses no threat to 11. She could just explode his head without even breaking stride.
No, I like how she reacts to the big city. It's everything that she's only really seen on TV. Like she finally feels like, okay, I'm experiencing the world. I have this freedom. I can just see everything in real life now. And I really like that little moment.
She arrives in the warehouse. We meet the outcasts, the Mohawk man, Cyndi Lauper, gum chewing girl, flannel, afro girl, and big strong black guy. And we meet them. And, you know, I've praised the show many times for giving us subtle characters. These are not subtle.
No, they are very obvious, very, you know, typical the way they set these scenes is typical outcasts out to get the ones who have done them wrong.
It kind of felt like Peter Pan almost to me, like Lost Boys.
Oh, like the Lost Boys. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I just, these characters did not work for me. This, yeah, they didn't work for me. It just didn't feel lived in. You know, like one of the strengths of the show, like Joyce and Hopper's relationship, we never get like whacked over the head with a flashback of they were really close or anything. It's subtly there. The kids, we get, you know, we get a sense of their relationship through their actions, not whacked over the head. These characters, it just feels like there's graffiti all over the walls. It feels like a different show. I don't know. I've always praised the show for not being pure 80s nostalgia. This part feels like they were like,
slap in the face.
Yeah. They, like here's four characters that would have been living in the 80s together for some reason. This guy's got his Motok meticulously manicured.
You know, I personally actually like the way they do this because I feel like they purposefully give you a sense of this is not where you want to stay. They give that with the scene setting, and I, you know, I'll talk a little bit more about it later in our episode here because I've got a lot of to cover.
Oh, good. Well, Callie and Eleven.
Coley, isn't it Coley?
Oh, is it Collie?
Collie? I think it's Collie. Yeah.
Spelled but Callie, you know, but she's also from London or potentially India or potentially, what's Dutch? What's country is Dutch? Denmark.
Denmark.
She's got a very Danish accent sometimes.
Oh, that's interesting.
And the paper says she's pulled from London, the missing persons paper. Anyway, they realize they're sisters. They show each other the tattoos. That's all pretty cool.
Yeah, you know when Eleven first walks in here, they're totally douchey, like I don't know, angsty young adults, and you know, up to no good. But then of course, Collie, I in all of my notes, I call her Eight. It just feels more comfortable to me. You know, we have Eleven as Eleven, and that is her identity, and maybe I should be calling her Collie because that's who she's chosen as her identity, but I stubbornly call her Eight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we call Eleven, Eleven and not Jane.
No, but Eleven is her identity. Her identity. Eleven is. True. Where it's not necessarily the same for Collie.
Well, we'll take I like taking the character's cue for what they call themselves. That seems to make the most sense to me.
Yeah.
So they compare their powers basically by showing each other what they can do versus the Mohawk Man.
Yeah.
Collie does the spiders on Mohawk Man's hand because he pulled a switchblade out. And then Eleven pulls the switchblade from
with
him
her powers.
With her Yoda powers.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I like that moment, that touching moment where they both are having that conversation. They're so happy to have each other. You know, I think this is your home. Eight says she feels whole now that Eleven is there, and Eleven agrees. Like, they have that shared history that nobody else has. Nobody in the world really can compare to them.
Except for 9 and 10. Where's 9 and 10?
Or presumably 1 through 7.
The next morning, Collie is going to give Elle the training to channel her power
through
anger, which is, I mean, the Duffer brothers talked a lot about Empire Strikes Back, and this is very, you know, Empire Strikes Back as the perfect sequel. And this is very Empire Strikes Back. Luke Skywalker needs to come to terms with his powers, and he goes to the Dagobah system to Yoda and learns a bunch of things. But this isn't quite that. She is, you said, through anger. Collie is telling Elle to use her anger. This is not the Force, you know, binds us and surrounds us makes us all one.
The Darth Vader.
Yeah, she's more of a Palpatine. Mm-hmm. This is how the Sith do their stuff. So at that point, I think we as audience are like, oh, right? We're supposed to be like, uh-oh. Yeah.
You know, honestly, I roll my eyes every time you bring up Star Wars, but it is just the perfect analogy. They are so intertwined, those two stories. Yeah. Like, it was purposefully done this way. So I really like the comparison there. But she says, use your anger. And and Eleven shows that she is more powerful when she focuses with her anger.
Yes.
But we know her history. We know, yes, anger is sometimes a fuel for her using her powers, but it's also love, her love and, you know, the protection she feels over her friends.
Well, Yoda says it. He says it. No, anger is easier, quicker, faster, but it's not the right way. It leads mm-hmm. to eventually your demise. And the one thing I don't like about that scene, and I loved that scene, and just at the very end, it's like if Yoda races the X-Wing and then we pan out to four people clapping. Like, oh, why? They were just sitting there the whole time in this emotional, tense moment between Kali and Eleven, and then there was just four, and they're like, yeah, go! Like, yeah. this was, in my opinion, a bad thing for Eleven to be taught.
It absolutely was. And again, it's more that feeling that you get that mm-hmm. this is not where Eleven is supposed to be. Yeah. You're not happy that she's here. You're not liking the dynamic. Mm-hmm. And whether that was purposefully done or accidentally done, I mean, you want her back in Hawkins, Indiana.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm saying that I didn't like the execution of the scene with the four people clapping. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do like that Eleven is learning the wrong lesson. This is important for the story of Eleven.
Absolutely.
I like that writing.
I do too, because really, like, she was on the edge of a knife with the way her life was going mm-hmm. before. She is being stuck in this cabin. Like, obviously things couldn't stay the way that they were. But again, I want to kind of cover that later in the episode. Let's kind of just track where she goes.
You're about to hit a part of my notes where I really need to dive in. Yeah, let's keep the summary going.
So basically, Kali tells her, you know, what they do. They mm-hmm. basically get revenge on all of the people who have wronged them or hurt them in the past. And so she wants Eleven to, quote, heal mm-hmm. by taking out her revenge, because that's how she'll lose her fear and she'll be able to move past this.
Yeah, she shows them the board. Anybody on here you recognize? She says, yeah. That one guy, that's the 450 guy who electronically lobotomized my mom.
Ray, whatever, I think his name is Ray.
He's got a last name.
Ray something or whatever. Ray,
the 450 guy. And they're going to go, and even though, despite the protests of some of the people in the Outcast for some reason, they're going to go and they're going to get this guy.
I mean, it's not like they have a leg to stand on protesting. They have no powers. They basically are at the mercy of 11 and 8 here.
I feel like the Afro girl's job, she was just in there to put some, like, I get those characters. Mm-hmm. I am not a fan of them. But
I don't know. I like the girl who's kind of always the lookout, that she's the driver. She's clearly not on the same level as Mohawk guy and
Cindy Lauper gum chewing girl.
Cindy Lauper gum chewing girl.
I would like to give them another chance. I want them to come back and let's add some layers to these onions with a different director, maybe. Honestly, this episode is poorly directed. Mm. That's what people get. Well, we're getting into my later.
Okay, thing. So basically they go, Eleven finds Ray, and you're seeing her development with her powers mm-hmm. because she's not having to have the, you know, stuff in the background.
Yeah, she just closes her eyes.
Yeah, she just closes her eyes and she's able to find him. So you really see her strengths. She's obviously getting stronger here. And she finds him. He's in this apartment complex. They go up, you know, do you know who we are? and then, you know, Eleven throws him across the room. Yeah.
I really like the moment when she said, do you know who we are? And then she shows him, as kids.
Yeah,
like, that was really powerful and cool.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool, too. And you can see the fear on his face. And then, obviously, so Eleven throws him across the room. And you do have this moment. You're empathizing with this guy. He's mm-hmm. talking about Dr. Brenner. I can show you where he's at. You know, he made me do it. Like, he is truly scared. And it makes you wonder, was he doing this of his own volition? Or was it really, like, you know, they told me that you were sick, you know.
I think people do very bad things, you know, talking about like the Nuremberg trials now, and we're not going to go too deep into it, but Kali is of the opinion that you had a choice.
You had
agency
and you did the wrong choice.
And maybe you regret it now, but here's the consequences of the choice, mm-hmm. you know, in a way, and you can see that this is very, you know, trials of Nuremberg and the Nazis and stuff like that, and mm-hmm. taking this to a galaxy far, far away again, and I apologize, but we are kind of in the throne room scene where Kali is Emperor Palpatine, Eleven is Luke Skywalker, and this guy is Darth Vader, and we're sympathizing for Vader. Vader's on the ground about to be slaughtered, and Palpatine's like, do it, do it. And we know, we as an audience, like, were you worried Eleven was going to do it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is a rewatch, so we knew she wasn't. But when we first watched, because it would take, it would completely deviate from her, the essence of her character.
Yes.
It would take her down a completely different path if she had killed him.
Now, many people criticize this part, and I do not criticize this part. But
I absolutely do not.
Well, they say that, once she sees the picture of the kids, you know, that somehow changes her mind. I think she's changing her mind before she sees the picture of the kids, in my opinion. She is not sure about this.
No, she's not. She's sitting there. She's choking him. Kali, number 8, tells her to do it slowly because she obviously wants him to suffer. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Eleven is doing it slowly because of suffering. I think that, she is on that knife's edge. She has the decision. If she kills this guy, there's no going back. Mm-hmm. Is she really going to do it? And then she sees the picture of the girls and can't help but make a comparison to her life.
Yeah.
You know, her parents were taken away from her. She doesn't want to do that to another child. And that is what pushes her to the other edge of the knife.
Yeah. I love the edge of the knife metaphor that you have here. It feels very true to why this episode needed to exist. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the episode didn't need to exist as a bottle episode, as a singular episode, but Eleven needed to go through this stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Mike and Hopper, they can't understand.
No.
With all these conversations, Kali is the perfect foil to Eleven for this. But anyway, they go back, they kind of discuss what happens. Kali says, you know, don't you ever take away my.
Yeah, because Eleven wouldn't even let Kali kill him either.
Yeah, and Eleven, I mean, she is a little girl. She's not really, she never even really had much social interaction outside of this. But then Kali, I think she turns full, I don't want to say full bad guy, but she's already on the path of guiding Eleven the wrong way. Mm-hmm. She really steps over the line when she tries to manipulate Eleven with a vision of Brenner.
Yeah.
That's where I'm like, oh, okay.
I absolutely don't think that she's doing it maliciously, though.
No,
I feel like she is doing it because she feels like this is the best way to help guide Eleven towards healing in obviously the wrong way.
Yeah, I think there's a tragedy that Kali doesn't have a mic, doesn't have a Hopper.
No.
She, you know, Kali is doing the things, practical things to get her way, and she just doesn't have this thread that Eleven does because of her relationships with the people she later flashes to, Mike, Dustin, Hopper, Joyce, all of them.
And you do get that sense, like, Eight, Kali really does want to help Eleven. She says after, you know, ending her little, like, being in Eleven's mind, showing her Dr. Brenner, she says that you have a choice to make, either run and hide or face those who hurt you, because she really, truly wants Eleven to get better. But she also, she's tainted by all of this vengeance that she feels. Mm-hmm. Which obviously is bad.
Yeah. And then a third aspect comes in when Eleven visits to see how Hopper is doing. Mm-hmm. And apparently the mushy peas weren't the only one listening to the speech from Hopper.
No, she
was.
Does
hear it.
She hears
that.
It. And you know, so you feel that connection that she still has with him. You see that she does love him and sees that he cares about her.
And then she finds out they are in danger. She watches the end of chapter 6.
Yeah.
where Hopper's like, uh-oh, oh no. And Mike's like, it's a trap. Or, you know,
it's a trap.
So Eleven now knows they're in danger, and that pushes her over the edge to decide that, you know, from Kali's perspective, no. Those people, they can't help you. They can't save you. And Eleven says the perfect thing.
But I can save them.
I love it.
Yeah, I love that too. And so the best thing about this episode, I've been wanting to talk about this since the beginning of the episode.
Okay.
The best thing about it is that obviously she has to move forward and have some sort of self-discovery. Because like you said, you know, Hopper, Mike, none of them can truly understand what she's gone through. But 8 can. But it allows her to see the perspective of actions driven by love and actions driven by hate. And when you see her flashback, she sees Hopper talking, you know, when he's calling the cabin to let her know why he's not there. And you see her make that comparison that everything he's done has been done from a place of love, mm-hmm. whereas everything that 8 has done has been done from this place of anger. Yeah. And so even though, you know, both actions are made, you know, in an attempt to improve the situation, love wins yeah. out.
And it feels only appropriate that during the, this is a very polarizing episode that a lot of people don't like. I'm going to bring up the sequel trilogy for Star Wars, another polarizing discussion. But in a way, what you just said is Rey. You know, Rey, so you can't just follow fear and anger, but the Jedi think to counter that, you just have to do pure dispassion. Mm-hmm. And Rey, you know, her part of that tale is no, not just pure cold dispassion with no attachments whatsoever, love. I'm going to do this mm-hmm. out of the people I care about and do good based on that, based on the love,
yeah.
which is how Luke defeats Darth Vader, by the way. So she's not like all out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, they're Anakin and Luke's love. Okay. You're looking at me like we're going to Star Wars. No, I understand.
I wanted to ask you because I just figured, you know, and I was just waiting for a moment where I can squeeze this in.
Yeah.
Presumably the Duffer brothers love Star Wars because there's so many connections here.
Definitely.
So is their work heavily influenced by the Star Wars then?
I think that yes. I think that this season is structured in an Empire Strikes Back way. Not perfectly structured, but I think they mm-hmm. very much thought
draw from that story.
You know, when people came out of a sequel, when were they happy? When were people happy? And it was after Empire Strikes Back. And they had tons of Star Wars references in season one. Yeah. So certainly
you know there's that influence.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of story structure there. What do people dislike about this episode? Can we skip to that question?
Can I tell you what I dislike about this
Absolutely.
Episode? Because, that is the question. Why do so many people hate it?
Yeah.
I actually really like this episode. I feel like it was very necessary, and it allowed that growth of 11, which we absolutely mm-hmm. needed. We needed her to be able to come back to Hawkins with love to be there for her friends. What I didn't like is how does she, who's never been in the world, figure out how the bus systems work? Okay? Like, she doesn't have the same powers of the mind to be able to, like, influence people to think that, oh, it's okay for her to be there. But you see her riding a bus twice. She's riding the Greyhound bus back to Hawkins. We already know she can kind of figure out map-wise how to get back there mm-hmm. with her mind. But, like, how does she know, like, how to pay? Does she have money? How does she pay for the bus fares to get on there?
That
is a hole in the plot line here. And I'm offended by it.
So we'll get to our feeler moment and our music moment, but this episode is polarizing. It is. I actually enjoyed it in rewatch.
Yeah.
But
more than the first time you watched it?
More than the first time I watched it. But that's because I know that we're going to come back to the regular story. I think it's very jarring to go from, you know, Stranger Things, every show, every public property, every movie, they teach you how to enjoy the show, right? Mm-hmm. And Stranger Things has taught us that this is one big movie. Season one is an 8-hour movie. And season two starts as a 6-hour movie. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, no, we're a TV show. We're going to do a bottle episode with only one character. It's jarring. You know, it's the first time we go in a non-linear, we're only going to follow one character. It comes out of the blue. Like if you were watching a movie and the first scene was this character, and then 5 hours later in the second movie, the character comes back. That's what happens with Collie.
Yeah.
It's very jarring. And, you know, I think that in knowing it was coming made it a lot easier for me.
You bring up a really good point here because I think when we watched this the first time, mm-hmm. to me, it wasn't as, but I don't remember, you know, having much trouble with this episode, but we binge watched it. Like we watched this episode and then right afterwards watched mm-hmm. the next episode and she's back in Hawkins. So I mean, that didn't affect me quite as much, but when you put it that way, are we going to be staying in Illinois?
What if all this stuff had been dispersed amongst the season? You know, that mm-hmm. might, it might've been a lot different. The other thing is the different vibe, the setting. I mean,
absolutely different.
A lot
polarizing.
Of people don't want to leave Hawkins. I don't want to leave Hawkins. Mm-hmm. You know me. I don't like when the Office characters leave the Office. I don't like when the Simpsons leave Springfield. I don't like when the Cheers gang leaves the Cheers bar. The setting of Hawkins, Indiana is a character in the show who I love. So that part is there. And really, the punks and Collie herself, you know, they're just not fleshed out. And they are abandoned after this. I'm assuming they're coming back some point. But we don't have any attachment to them. And I think the directing for this show is the final piece that I'd like to talk about. I think that this is the worst directed show episode of the thing. It is way too ham-fisted. The examples I use primarily are the Channel 8 thing that Terry Ives' mom says. You know, she's watching Channel 8 as 11. Like, it's on that for like 10 seconds, zooming in on it. Like, you stupid audience. Can you get this? It's Channel 8, right? Channel 8, and she's going after 8. You stupid idiots. You get this? Like, that's how I felt.
Miles
like,
is unhappy.
The Mohawk guy and the Cyndi Lauper girl with gum. It's just so... just, I don't know, it's sort of different than season one, which puts us in this world that felt very lived in, and this one didn't. This one felt like we were being presented with a television show, and I think the ideas themselves, the heart of this episode, Collie and Eleven, completely works for me.
Oh, and therefore is completely necessary. I love that dynamic.
I remembered the Outcasts being in this episode a lot more than they were because of that, and so rewatching it wasn't that bad. You cannot skip this episode.
No,
I see people saying I skip this. Like, you absolutely need it.
No, how can you? Yeah. How do you then understand how Eleven came to accept coming back to Hawkins? Mm-hmm. Like, and that doesn't make any sense. This is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and so I said like I didn't want to leave Hawkins, and I wanted to go to Chicago and stuff like that. But this had to happen.
Yeah.
This absolutely had to happen. I talked a lot about Hopper having no step two. You know, Eleven is just in a cabin. And what's step two? Step two is that Eleven has to choose Hopper and Mike and Hawkins.
On her own self-discovery.
She has to. For that to happen, she's got to have freedom. Exactly. Self-discovery. She's on the knife's edge, and she's allowed to be on the knife's edge. Mm-hmm. And that's different. Otherwise, if this doesn't happen, then everything else that Eleven does for the benefit of Hawkins is sort of a variation of her captivity.
Yeah. No?
Like she rightly points out to Hopper. We needed to see this. We needed someone to unlock her powers as well.
Yeah.
You know, that's that Collie really says like, hey, you know, look, you're way more powerful than you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Should we go into the feeler moments?
Yes, I believe so. I'm just checking my notes to see if there's anything else I wanted to rip into this episode for. Oh, I guess my final point was like, did this episode have to be a standalone episode? Is that maybe why? I mean, I guess I did kind of cover that.
I like that it was standalone. I like that it's separate.
I think the episode might age better when Collie has interacted with more than just this one episode.
Yeah. Oh, I believe that we are going to be seeing a lot more of Collie in season four. Yeah. And I'm really excited about that.
8 will be back and maybe 9 and 10. Where's 9 and 10?
It's like Game of Thrones and the White Walkers. Like, you see Collie and then you don't see her for a whole season.
But Game of Thrones is a great example in reverse. Game of Thrones taught us that it takes entire seasons for characters to get places and stuff like that. They taught us how to enjoy the show, and then in the final season, they broke that.
Oh,
they broke the rules that they set.
Suddenly,
characters are teleporting all over the place in the final seasons.
Yeah.
Like, you establish the rules of your world, and then you must follow them. And when you don't, that's when stuff starts to go wrong.
It's like going back to one of our questions from that we did in season one. Do we think that it was right to continue the series, or do we think it should have been a standalone, you know, one season? And I think it's going to be entirely dependent on how they end the show.
Yeah.
Like Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones was supposed to be amazing, and then they absolutely ruined it.
Yeah. At least see Stranger Things, the one difference there is Stranger Things season one resolves.
Yeah.
Doesn't end. Every Game of Thrones cliffhanger was building towards nothing.
Yeah. Season one can still be a standalone. Really?
Yeah. So it can still function that way. All right. We thought this was going to be a quick episode.
I think there was a lot feelings wise to digest in this episode. Yeah. And again, I really liked this episode, but I know a lot of people didn't. I'd like to just kind of shout out my feeler moment here. And it was, you know, one of the final scenes when Collie and Eleven separate. And you see her looking out the window and she's looking out with shock, but like also that mixed emotion of pain. Like she's losing that piece. She had finally felt whole. She felt somebody that she could actually truly connect with, which she's never really had. And now that connection is leaving her. And it's just such a short moment. Yeah. Nothing is said in that moment. All you see is her face looking out the window, but you feel all of it. You feel that shock. You feel that pain. You feel that heartache, that, you know, rip of that connection. I really liked that moment.
Yeah, I really felt like her life has been changed by her short time with Eleven.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Music moment. Hey-o! For the first time, we get an element of 80s music that we have not gotten. The fast-paced hi-hat and the wailing guitar. I'm not sure if it's actually a guitar. This is like the classic big city cop duo movies. Yeah. You know, this is very, very 80s. And I said, you know, in season one, the 80s soundtrack of Stranger Things, not really 80s. But here it is. Here it is, like truly. And 80s music, you know, lacks a lot of dynamics. Lacks some bass sometimes. They kind of got into a digital mode and they kind of overused it in the 80s. Mm. And the soundtrack by Stein and Dixon, you know, truly isn't 1980s music. I mean, I know I talked about that a lot in season one. It's not. 80s music is tinny and just...
You're not a huge I'm not fan a huge of 80s fan. Music.
Well, and you can look at it outside of nostalgia. Bands in the 60s, bands in the 70s, bands in the 90s, bands in the 2000s, like many of them get new fans all the time.
Yeah.
80s right there is just like we lost a little bit of production value. We compressed the hell out of everything. We lost a little bit, but this is a complete side note. Anyway, I like that little moment where we got kind of the TV show, movie, sort of cheap big city. I love that little wailing
again,
thing.
Not Hawkins, Indiana. You feel that separation.
Yeah, you feel it, and the music reflects it as well. Yeah. All right, great episode, my beautiful wife. My name is Miles.
I'm Kathleen.
And we will see you for Chapter 8.
Okay. Yeah.